Ukraine bombs a beach filled with families, kills 4 kids. The death toll's growing. They also bombed a crowded cafe over the weekend, but apparently we're being told it's not terrorism. How can that not be terrorism? Here's what else you need to see.
I'm really worried about where we're headed as a country. The biggest thing of all that we're facing right now is this massive debt. But it's now escalated to a level that no one can ignore.
When it comes to the state of Israel, there is no interest in joining the campaign. The current situation, where there is a confined campaign between Iran and the United States, is the correct and best for us.
Baby, f*** you, baby. That's how our tax dollars
going.
That's
your taxes right there.
The head of CENTCOM is being advised by this top Israel lobbyist to escalate against Iran.
Can you believe that? That's the bombing on the beach that I told you about, that video. We're going to show it to you again in just a little bit and explain it to you. The U.S., by the way, is in a bad way these days, and the young people in the United States are calling it out. The effect is next. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and I want to start off by showing you what the U.S.'s former Secretary of Transportation, cabinet member, is saying about his country. Our country, America, right? My country, right? In this very popular podcast that has been viewed all over the world. Watch, listen to his words.
I'm really worried about where we're headed as a country right now. America's system is so out of whack that if you are a multi-billionaire, you probably pay a lower percentage in taxes than if you're a school teacher or a firefighter. You have levels of inequality that we've almost never seen. There's a rise in political violence, the collapse in trust, and the biggest thing of all that we're facing right now is this massive debt. But it's now escalated to a level that no one can ignore.
Out of whack, he said, right? A system that is so out of whack that no one can ignore it. Not true, by the way. 30% of Americans ignore it, mostly the ones that are watching state TV channels like, you know, CNN, Fox. They ignore it. They're still backing President Trump's war with Iran, as goofy as that may sound. But then there's the rest of America, led now, most of all, by young people who are against the war, and they're holding Israel responsible for the war. That's the reality of what's happening in the United States. And what are the Israelis saying about that? You'd think that they'd be at least saying, oh, we're sorry you feel that way, and maybe showing some gratitude for all the money, the tens of billions of dollars that the American taxpayers are sending them, or maybe saying thank you for the wars that American soldiers have bled, died for, fighting for them. No, that's not what Israel's saying at all. In fact, listen to this recent comment by the Israeli finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich.
I'll say this. When it comes to the state of Israel, there is no interest in joining the campaign. The current situation, where there is a confined campaign between Iran and the United States, is the correct and best for us. Our objective in the campaign, and this is not necessarily shared with the U.S., is to destabilize, weaken, to the point of overthrowing the regime. The best way right now to bring down the regime is economically. Therefore, the current situation is good for us, and we have no interest in pushing ourselves in.
You notice he's speaking in Hebrew, and you heard what he said there. I don't know, did you catch when he said, I don't want the United States to know this, or we're not saying this to the United States. What he is saying is, what Smotrich is saying there is that Israel doesn't need to fight the war against Iran and doesn't want to, because they've convinced Mr. Trump to do it for them. He says they're better off staying out of it. He says that way the United States will weaken Iran, and then Israel will benefit from a weak Iran. He just said that. There it is. He's literally saying the quiet part out loud. Now, this comment, it's really made a lot of people angry in the United States. It's angered many Americans who already felt used by Israel to begin with. But now, I'll tell you who's really irritated by this. Somebody I know very well, Tucker Carlson, he went on X, and this is what he wrote when he watched that video. He says Israel's finance minister just bragged the other day about having the American soldiers fight Netanyahu's wars. He says it's the best for us. Smotrich doesn't want to die for Israel. Why should he, right, when he's got Americans dying for Israel? You know, it's hard to argue with Tucker's indignity there. But then again, Tucker went even further, and he said something I didn't know about when I read his ex post. He said something that is a true sign of Israel's brazenness, right? According to Tucker's sources, the head of the U.S. military, that is, the guy who's conducting the Iran war, is taking his orders from Israel, or a representative of Israel. Tucker writes, here, put it up, Gene, there it is. Why is Admiral Bradley Cooper, the man in charge of the Iran war, secretly taking strategic advice from crazed Israel shill Mark Dubowitz? So, who is Mark Dubowitz? I didn't know. So I went to the Gray Zone's Max Blumenthal. Here's the answer.
This is Mark Dubowitz. He's basically Israel's top guy on K Street at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, which was originally founded as EMET, E-M-E-T, a organization which in its original founding documents said its goal was to enhance Israel's image in the United States. It's basically Israel's main think tank that has devised every aspect of this war. And according to Tucker, the head of CENTCOM is being advised by this top Israel lobbyist to escalate against Iran.
That's crazy, right? Israel is advising our military officials in the United States and telling them what to do to escalate the war with Iran. If you're thinking that doesn't sound at all to you like America first, which is what Americans were promised, you're right. You're right. And that's why Americans, and in particular young Americans, are now disgusted. Look at this not-so-nice welcome given to Netanyahu as he arrived in the United States over the weekend. Whereas before, Israeli leaders were either applauded, ignored, or at least tolerated by Americans, Netanyahu, he's hated right now.
That's our tax dollars
going.
That's
your taxes right there.
There's an imposter coming to the White House. There is somebody who is using the Holy Star of David as a cudgel to murder, to occupy, to oppress.
There's a lot of meat there, right? There's a lot of messaging there that makes you understand how America feels right now. Last night, I had a chance to talk to Ethan Levins. He is a U.S. podcaster. He's got a massive audience, millions of people. He's a typical young American dude, right? He used to care very little about politics. But now he is helping to lead this movement against the establishment in the United States. So last night, he joined me in a conversation about what's happening in America. And I asked him to explain to us if there's really a sense of awakening, maybe even a revolt taking place, especially among young people in the United States. That's the question.
That's 100% true. And that's been like the top story over the past year is you have this older population in the U.S., which is essentially the politicians at this point. They're not understanding it. I have family members that have to try to sit down and it's like, look, Iran is not going to drop a nuke on Miami tomorrow. It's just not going to happen. I can assure you they don't have a missile that can reach the U.S. I thought the nuclear facilities were destroyed last June of 2025. Trump paraded about that. That was false. And the younger generation, like you said, essentially under 35, under 40 even, there's a lot of people that just, you're being fed this over and over again. And people are thinking to themselves, you know, it started February 28th. We're in August now. It's still going on. We're hearing the same rhetoric. Why haven't we won yet? Why haven't we won yet? What exactly are we doing anymore? My gas prices are going higher. And one thing about living in the U.S. is, honestly, a lot of Americans are just dumb when it comes to geopolitics and politics because you're so isolated. You're not really affected by what is actually happening in the world. But there's one thing that history has shown that will make an American mad, and that is gas prices. That's pretty much the only thing. And as Americans, and as me, I pay $5 a gallon for gas. You start asking the question, what happened? What happened to Trump? I thought this was going to go down. You start Googling, you research it, and the truth is that younger people are the ones that have TikTok, they have X, they have YouTube. They're actually watching these videos and older people are kind of sticking to the Fox News, you know, and Fox News is going to tell you we're winning the war. We have to do this for 47 years. This regime, it started 47 years ago when they took the embassy hostage and that, you know, we're finishing what started all back then and that my kids and their kids are going to be safe now. And it's just all a lie.
He's a smart guy. I mean, he's young, he's male, he's conservative, and he's from the South. What is that? Think about that. Think about it. What is that a perfect combination of. That describes the voters who helped put Mr. Trump back in the White House for a second term. And they're literally saying, we feel lied to. We feel betrayed. And they're making a stink on social media platforms. But how long can that last? I'm beginning to wonder, you know, on places like YouTube. I just learned this morning that YouTube has now conducted a, quote, another enforcement push as of today, which means that they don't like what you're saying on YouTube, they'll shut you down. My own YouTube channel was just shut down again today, right? After showing remarkable growth, which may have been the reason it was shut down. So this is why channels like BitChute, for example, BitChute's not owned by tech companies that have ties to the state, to the government, to the Pentagon, to the Trump administration, to Congress. Not, right? So places like this are becoming safer for free speech. This is my page there on BitChute, for example. Check it out, right? So look, the point I'm trying to make is whether tech companies are able to weaken the message by canceling shows like this one remains to be seen. But one thing is certain. The shows on state media, you know, the stuff people used to watch on CNN or Fox, they're dying. But yet that's where people like Alan Dershowitz, for example, would appear in, night in and night out. This is where guys like that, these old guys who start the wars and do horrible things, they go on there and they're treated like statesmen. They're treated like they're visiting scholars, right? Alan Dershowitz. But look what happens when a guy like Alan Dershowitz has to go on an alternative platform and he has to face off with somebody who would not be allowed to face off with him on CNN or Fox. Somebody like Professor Mirandi. Watch this.
You say Israel is not a colonial regime? You're from Eastern Europe. You're European. All of those Ashkenazi European Jews who are now running the country, they're from Eastern Europe. You came and slaughtered. I'm talking. I didn't interrupt you as you were ranting. The people who you support, the people who are running the country, they're Polish. They're Ukrainian. They're from Czechoslovakia. They're from Eastern Europe. You're not even Semite. You're the anti-Semite because you've been slaughtered. You won't let me talk. You are afraid. You're afraid because you know you have no argument. You have no leg to stand on. You slaughtered the Semite Palestinians and you took their land. You are a proud Zionist who supports a regime that celebrates the rapists in prison.
This thing has gone viral. I mean, millions of people are watching this because he just destroyed him. I mean, he wiped the floor with him, right? Especially given what's, the whole world knows that has happened in Gaza. So on that, let me ask you a question. When is not calling out terrorism in and of itself a form of terrorism? What about if you're colluding with the terrorists? What if you're training the terrorism, right? What if you're arming the terrorists? What if you're funding it, right? Are you not then a terrorist yourself? Is that not a good question? Is that not an appropriate question? And by the way, I'm not talking about Gaza in this case. I say this because over the weekend, something happened which, if proven, makes it hard to take NATO and the EU seriously. So we know this. Ukraine has bombed oil refineries. They've bombed schools. I was there. I saw it, right? They've bombed apartment buildings. They've bombed online commerce warehouses. And what has the EU, what has NATO done? They've smugly condoned all of it. But now, it's worse. Over the weekend, an apparent suicide bomber, he walks into a crowded cafe with a homemade explosive in downtown Moscow. And by the time she was done, at least 3 people were killed. 11 more were injured. If not for the quick thinking of the doorman who stopped her at the entrance and lost his life in the process, the number of those killed, the number of people she would have killed would have been in the hundreds probably because the restaurant was packed, right? It was a weekend. Just yesterday at a beach, you got to see this, at a beach filled with people vacationing, watch this. Boom. See that? This is a beach. These are children playing with their moms and dads and their brothers and sisters. A Ukrainian drone hits a beach. As you can see from the video that's taken from the water, it happened right on the shoreline. Horrified families were there watching. 8 people were killed. 4 of them were little kids, children. Yeah, this is crazy. So as you watch this, you can't help but ask the question, where's the condemnation? Where's the EU? Where's NATO saying that's not right? You can't do that. Surely they can't call this drone attack on a beach or the suicide bombing of in a restaurant a legitimate military tactic, can they? Yes, they can, they will, and they do right now. They have not condemned this, which leaves anybody looking at this to wonder, what the hell's it going to take then? How far does Ukraine have to go in attacking Russian civilians? Civilians. Before Ursula von der Leyen or Mark Rutte or any of these colleagues of theirs in the EU or NATO acknowledges that what they're doing, this is terrorism. I mean, you damn well know that if it was a Muslim country, they'd be all over it calling terrorists, radical terrorists, no doubt. You know? Listen, have they done anything? Have they said anything yet? But I promise I'll let you know when it happens. When Ursula von der Leyen comes out and says something about this being terrorism, I will let you know. But here, do me a favor. No, do yourself a favor. Don't hold your breath. All right, time to check in with my colleague, Che Bose. He does this segment for us every Tuesday. It's called Eye on Europe. And boy, were a lot of people's eyes on Europe this weekend, especially down around in between Spain and Northern Africa, right? What was that, Che?
Yeah, Rick, and it's a fascinating story, okay? And interestingly, you are one of the very few people who knows where this actually happened. This happened in a place called Ceuta. It's Spanish territory, but the Western media is running this narrative that, of course, this was an invasion of Spain by migrants, okay? But I decided to have a little look into the background of all this to see what actually happened. You can see the scenes here. It was almost post-apocalyptic, right? You've got literally tens of thousands of people, estimates from 50,000 to 80,000 young men mainly, pouring across the border of this small territory called Ceuta. Now, here's something very interesting. Where is Ceuta? It's not technically in Spain, although it's Spanish territory. It's actually in Northern Africa, okay? And this is where it gets interesting, okay? Check out where Ceuta is, and here's our map, right? Mm-hmm. Ceuta is on the very tip of the African continent, if you like. You can see it there. And you see all those little Spanish flags peppered along the Mediterranean coast on the north of Africa. They're all Spanish territories, right? Now, you may ask yourself, why is a country like Spain that's so interested in freedom for Palestinians and freedom for, various minorities, not interested in giving this territory back? This territory of Ceuta, Melilla, and many others along the coast, the strategic outposts of the Spanish, remnants of the Spanish Empire, are contested. The Moroccans say this is our territory. And I think if you look at the map, this is Africa. This ain't Spain, okay? Right. It's quite simple, okay? Now, in the 1920s in particular, the Spanish and their friends in France prosecuted a brutal colonial war in what is now Morocco, okay? They put down various rebellions. Check this out. These are Spanish legionnaires holding the heads of local Moroccan civilians who they decapitated. These guys killed at least 60,000 civilians. They were one of the first countries to ever use chemical weapons against civilian populations, okay? Dropping this stuff out of aircraft, okay? Absolutely remarkable stuff. Poisoning wells. So there's no love lost between the Moroccans of today and the Spanish empire, if you like, okay? Now, this is not what they're going to tell you in the Western media. Now, you mentioned the fact that this must be coordinated in some way, okay? Yeah. But it might speak to why, you know, people are saying the Moroccans didn't try and stop these young men pouring into Ceuta. Many of those young men and probably the Moroccan government believe that this is actually not Spanish territory in the first place. Maybe they were trying to destabilize it. So there's always a story within the story. You don't always have to look for the conspiracy. Sometimes you just got to look in the history book, okay? The man in charge of Spain right now, okay? A guy called Pedro Sanchez.
Nice
okay?
last name.
It's a very illustrious Spanish name. Great name, okay? Now, we got our own, we got a Sanchez effect in Moscow, okay? Which is a very positive effect. You know, you're doing great work for the truth. But there's also a Sanchez effect happening in Spain. Check this out. Check out Pedro Sanchez. He decided to give 500,000 EU passports, right? 500,000 to illegals who had poured over the border just to clear this away and put it under the carpet. Now, you got to ask yourself as well now, when it comes to what happened in Ceuta, if Pedro decided to give away 500,000 EU passports, because the Spanish passport allows you to travel right across the European Union, remember, gives you rights to residency, to social care, etc. Would you imagine that these young men pouring into Ceuta might have thought, well, he's given away 500,000 already, maybe we'll get some more? This is not something that is being talked about either in the media. Just like the final thing I want to mention. Mr. Sanchez, okay, has been an absolutely energetic supporter of Ukraine. And we were talking about what happened on the beach in the Krasnodar Krai, okay, this attack. Those drones are paid for by somebody, and they're paid for by people like Pedro Sanchez. He's given billions of euros to Mr. Zelensky. He's given Leopard tanks. He's been an enthusiastic supporter of the Kiev regime. And we see what's happening. The bombings in Moscow, the killing of these kids on the beaches. That stuff has got to be paid for, because we know Ukraine has a basket case economy. Maybe Pedro has decided to be so enthusiastic about supporting, you know, Palestine, which is probably a good thing, but he's not so interested in freedom for the people of Morocco when it comes to the territories they occupy. He's not interested in freedom for the people in Crimea, who voted, you know, overwhelming to be part of Russia, people of Donbass, Lugansk, places you and I have traveled to see what Spanish money, Italian drones are doing on those very territories. So it's very important, I think, for the viewers to look beyond the headlines that are very convenient. The horrible Moroccans are coming. They're pouring over the border. It's like, you know, they're invading the mainland of Spain. This didn't even technically happen in Spain. Now, one thing to end, Pedro has some problems at home as well. His wife, Begonia Sanchez, is facing corruption charge, influence peddling charges in Spain. So this is another opportunity for him to say, hey, look over there, look at Ceuta, we're under attack.
Yeah.
Let's look at Spain, the Russians are coming. His brother, David Sanchez, also, I've been doing some digging, he was banned from holding public office for 9 years. Mr. Sanchez has got a lot of problems at home. And just like a lot of the most enthusiastic European leaders when it comes to Kiev and Mr. Zelensky and pretending they're not killing kids on beaches or blowing people up in restaurants in Moscow, have a lot of domestic problems which they'd rather we didn't know about or think about, Rick.
Well, then let me just state for the record that there is no relation between that Sanchez and the Sanchez, just in case you all were wondering. Good stuff, man. Thanks for reporting the things that we often miss, because those on state TV in the West won't report that kind of stuff. Good to see you again, Che. See you soon.
Thanks, Rick.
When we come back, what we're going to do is we're going to pick up a lot of these subjects that are taking place. I mean, it's a hot day for news, right? Especially if you look at what happened over the weekend. Canadian economist and geopolitical expert Dr. Radhika Desai. She's fantastic, by the way. She and I have had a lot of long conversations in the past, but this time we're going to do it on TV. Radhika Desai joins us when we come back after the break. Don't go away. She knows her political science because she's a professor of political studies. She's also the director of geopolitical studies, and she's good enough to join us now. Radhika Desai is the good professor, is going to spend some time talking to us right now. Geopolitical economics, I should say, research group at the University of Manitoba, for those of you who wanted to know. Doctor, it's always great to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Always great to be with you, Rick. How are you?
I'm good. What do you make of the crazy things that happened over the weekend? Let's start with Mr. Trump. All of a sudden, he decides, I'm done. I'm putting a pause to the war again, by the way, again. And I think that's the key word here. What do you make of Mr. Trump's declaration?
Well, I think that, it's a very, very simple, this one. It requires two or three points. Number one, Trump has lost the war. Number two, at the same time, he cannot afford to admit that he's lost the war. So especially until the November midterm elections are over. So at least until then, we can expect him to yo-yo between, you know, claiming to fight a war, which is there is nothing to fight. He's already lost. But, you know, a few bombs here and there, which will create the impression that he's still fighting the war. And then claiming that there will be a ceasefire. You know, and just now, in fact, he has put out once again that there is going to be, you know, Scott Bessent has come out and said that there are negotiations with Iran and what have you. Iran has explicitly said they're not talking to the United States. So where does Scott Bessent get this from? I mean, there is another element to this, as you know very well. Trump and his friends and cronies benefit and speculate on the swings in oil prices that inevitably accompany each announcement. When Trump says we are at war and he bombs a few places, then the price of oil rises. When Trump says we are having negotiations, our price of oil drops. And those who know, even microseconds earlier, that he's going to make these announcements stand to benefit enormously. Mm. And as you know, Rick, Trump is actually selling the privilege of getting these, you know, his announcements on Truth Social a couple of minutes before, microseconds before they go out at the price of $100,000 a month.
Listen to what you just said. And it's not like you're far removed. You're in Canada. You're right there.
Yes.
There's people talking about U.S. policy and Canadian policy every day that you run into on the streets, not to mention your students and your colleagues at the university. What you just said is an American president right now is making all, if not almost all, geopolitical decisions based on one thing, how much money he can put in his pocket from that decision. That's what you just said. Is there any other American president or Canadian prime minister that you can literally nail on that?
I think that Trump certainly takes the cake. I mean, there have been, of course, many presidents who are corrupt. And of course, remember that the word corruption has become very dubious in the Western context, because 50 years of neoliberalism means that what used to be corrupt yesterday has, thanks to deregulation, become legal today.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, the bounds of legality. So, in fact, as you know, you can make a very long list of the things Trump has done so that he and his family and his friends can benefit personally from his presidency.
Yeah.
This is a list is a very long one, including not putting his assets in a blind trust, having Jared Kushner and Witkoff jet all over the world. These people have no diplomatic skills. They are allegedly, supposedly making peace. Of course, they're not making peace. They are making deals. They are making deals that will benefit the family and Trump and friends. Whether there is war or peace, who cares? Who cares if a million people die?
But that's the point that you're making, which I think is extraordinary. And I want to make sure people don't lose sight of exactly what you're saying. Yes, look, we're all a little corrupt. I'm a little corrupt, okay? I'll be honest with you. If I can pay less money on my taxes, of course I will. I'm going to have my accountant do whatever he can within the bounds of, you know, ethics or whatever it's called so that, you know, I don't go to jail. But, yeah, I'm not going to overpay. And I guess, you know, we all, to a certain extent, do that. All politicians will, if they can get their hand in the cookie jar a little bit, will do it. But what we're talking about here is different. We're talking about a friggin' war. We're talking about people dying. And that's a difference, right?
Well, and I'll say two other things quickly. I mean, sure. I mean, you described, you know, your attitude to paying taxes, but there are people who have other attitudes to paying taxes. People who say, I want good roads. I want good hospitals. I want good schools. I am happy to pay the taxes I am due to pay.
Yeah.
This is a perfectly legitimate attitude. One does not have to evade taxes, avoid taxes, whatever the word is. So the point is...
But let me just stop you for a minute there. It just so happens that in my country, country, the tax dollars are not being used to help the roads, help the schools, help the children, or feed the poor. In my country, the United States of America, the taxes are used exclusively for Israel and Ukraine and wars and Raytheon, et cetera, not to mention the tech companies. And that might be a good reason.
But Rick, okay, just on that point. Very good. That's a very important and excellent point. But I suggest that rather than just personally evade taxes, why don't you start a taxpayers' movement saying, no, none of my tax dollars are going to go into the war machine? I think that would be really great. But I want to say a couple of other things. What I want to say is that even though the list of the ways in which Trump has manifestly been corrupt is actually very long, there is not a single law that he has violated, which means that 50 years of neoliberalism, plus, of course, Trump's own massive deregulation of all sorts of things, have actually brought us to the point where you can't prosecute him for anything. But you know that he's doing something very wrong. And one final point, the biggest thing he's doing is he's trying to ensure that he wins elections. Now, I'm not saying he's going to succeed, but he's doing everything in his power to ensure that the Republicans maintain control of Congress. It is extremely unlikely, which is also why he is preparing the ground for challenging the result of the election. Last time, he had to stage his January 6th, whatever thing, whatever he did.
Yeah.
This time around, he will be a sitting president. So think about that. He is doing everything in his power to ensure that he can cast doubt on the election that will take place if the result does not go his way, which is very likely. So we are going to, like, you know, fasten your seatbelts because you're in for a bumpy ride.
If they were to do, and this is just a quick question because I'm just curious because you happen to be in Canada and I find Canada to be a fascinating and interesting place with Carney and all. But if they had a poll tomorrow in Canada, you know your neighbors. How many of them do you think, if they asked them, do you think Donald Trump should remain the president of the United States, what percentage of them would vote in the affirmative that, yes, he should remain as president of the United States?
I would say pretty small, because I'll tell you what. Not only did the current prime minister win elections by being a sort of anti-Trump, and his opponent lost because until then, he was essentially trying to portray himself as a kind of mini Trump. Mm. So not only did that happen, but since then, the way in which Trump has dealt with Canada has led to widespread revulsion against Trump in Canada. So, of course, it'll be a tiny minority. I mean, you have to be pretty nuts in Canada to think that Trump is a good thing. Trump being president of the U.S. Is a good thing for Canada.
Let's move to the situation this morning and over the weekend in Russia, where I just saw the video. I don't know if our viewers missed it. We can show it again. This is video of a beach where a beach is hit with a drone. This is crazy. Just kids and their families frolicking and playing on the beach. Watch this. Vacationers, a seaside, and a drone comes in and kills eight people. Four of them were just little kids. And by the way, the day before that, a suicide bomber walked into a restaurant in Moscow. Look at that. Oh, Jesus. And I guess she blew herself up and she took a bunch of people with her, apparently killed three people. I mean, this sounds like terrorism to me, whether you're on Ukraine's side or Russia's side. This should be condemned, but yet no word from the EU, no word from NATO. What do you make of that?
Well, this has been Zelensky's gambit. If you remember, just prior to the Ankara summit, NATO summit, basically what had been decided among between Zelensky and his supporters, both within Ukraine and in the EU,
yeah.
It had been decided that Ukraine had to come out looking like a winner. Like Ukraine had to look like it was managing to inflict considerable damage on Russia. So essentially, he's been on a campaign to inflict these kind of, you know, he has been inflicting these kind of retail violence on Russia. That's all he's capable of doing. And remember that, you know, you use the word terrorism historically. terrorism is the weapon of the weak in the sense that when you cannot really fight your enemy in an actual battle, then you undertake terrorism. And this has often been done for good reasons as well. And you know the old saying, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter.
Yeah.
So I don't want to go too far into that, but I'm just saying that this is an objective. You know, when you resort to terrorism, it shows your weakness. And that is certainly the case with Zelensky, because first of all, there is a lot of media hype around each one of these attacks, whether it's on a refinery with a drone or in this case, you know, attacking civilians in restaurants and beaches and so on. I mean, they make a big deal out of it in order to show that somehow Ukraine is managing to inflict a lot of damage on Russia, that Ukraine is damaging Russia's economy. And most importantly, the impression is attempted to be given that whatever Ukraine is doing is undermining support for President Putin in Russia. And I can tell you, and you probably know better than me, but I can certainly tell you that in my experience of Russia, usually the effect is the opposite.
Of course, of course. Yes. Just like it's happened in Iran. Well, you're in London right now. And
Correct. When
I read The Guardian and when I read or watch the BBC, I don't get a sense that when they're reporting these incidents of civilians, I mean, attacks on apartments, for example, we see rocket going into an apartment and killing a family in an apartment. I mean, these are civilian targets. And you're right, they report on it, but there's no sense of this is wrong in their reporting. It's almost like another blow for the Putin presidency or the Russian government, as today more people died when Ukraine hit them with a missile, et cetera, et cetera. When we all know that that missile, by the way, was guided, built for, and paid for by the British.
I'm afraid you are absolutely right. The ruling classes, the political classes in Britain have certainly demonstrated their complete commitment to Ukraine. As you know, we've just had another change of prime minister. On the ground, among the people, the Ukraine war is definitely not popular. Nevertheless, even before he took office, Andy Burnham has basically reiterated his support for Ukraine. As you know, Zelensky was his first foreign visitor at 10 Downing Street. So the two of them have already kind of done their, bromance, bonding, whatever you want to call it. And so the UK stands behind them. It's funny, you're absolutely right about about the BBC and The Guardian and so on. I was listening to the BBC's recent report, this morning, Steve Rosenberg in Moscow, reporting on, whatever has been damaged most recently. And I was saying, and then he reported on some rally that Putin was having in Siberia and what have you. So I was joking to a friend. I said that if even Steve Rosenberg, who is about as anti-Putin as you can get, it's surprising that he's still reporting from Moscow. But nevertheless, if even Steve Rosenberg could not find conclusive evidence that people in Russia are moving against Putin, then nobody else will. Because if there is anything to be found, he will find it.
What does that say, by the way? Because there are people watching us from all over the world. We've got 10 to 20 million people who watch our broadcast now weekly. And people are going to find interesting what you just say, because they have no idea who the hell this Steve Rosenberg guy is. He's some correspondent for the BBC.
He's the BBC correspondent in Moscow, yes.
But what does it say that there is a BBC correspondent in Moscow who is anti-Putin, anti-Russian government, and he's allowed the freedom of speech to report every day from Moscow, while most people who are reporters for, Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, Russia, name your country, are not allowed to report or even step foot these days, because some of my friends have tried to step foot in London and they've been kicked out or they have literally been detained at the airport and sent back to their country. So, isn't that funny?
Not only that, I mean, I can't visit the RT website from here. In fact, in recent days, I haven't been able to visit the Press TV website, which I regularly, try to visit if I hear, Trump administration saying, oh, we are negotiating. My first resort is to go to the Press TV website. It used to be accessible to me even a few days ago, but as of the last two or three days, I haven't even been able to visit that website.
Yeah.
So much for internet freedom.
Yeah, and here's a guy who's anti-Putin, anti-Russia, working in, of course, Russia, which is supposed to be communist, according to people who probably still work at The Guardian, and people like Piers Morgan, and authoritarian, aggressive country. They've got a guy working for the BBC there every day, and he goes to Putin's news conferences, and he gets in his face. I mean, that doesn't sound so authoritarian to me, does it?
Not to me, absolutely not, yeah, no.
It's crazy, but, I mean, these are the things that, again, the people in the West don't know about. Speaking of a country that really is authoritarian, let's switch over to Israel and Bibi Netanyahu's latest foray into the United States. And we learned from Tucker Carlson that Bradley Cooper, the guy in charge of the war, the Navy dude, is literally getting marching orders from Israelis lobbyists on what to do in Iran. How crazy is that?
Well, on this matter, Rick, I will say that I have never really liked this narrative that, you know, Israel is the tail wagging the U.S. Foreign policy dog. Uh-huh. I think that the United States supports Israel for its own reasons. The United States has a imperial project, and Israel is an important piece of that imperial project. So that's my view of it. However, what we are now entering vis-a-vis both Netanyahu and Zelensky is a new and dangerous phase. And I was thinking about it today, you know, just reading what whatever has been said. You know, so many people are reporting about, you know, the Ukrainian strike on the Iranian vessel in the Caspian Sea, this attempt to try to merge the two wars, something that Netanyahu, it seems, would welcome. So to me, you know, what does this bring to mind? It brings to mind William Butler Yeats's poem, The Second Coming. One of the verses in it, you know, refers to the falcon no longer being able to hear the falconer. It says, turning and turning in a widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart, the center cannot hold, mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. So now, I don't wish to say that, you know, this is some kind of inadvertent, oh, he just can't hear. What I'm saying is that these two falcons, namely Zelensky and Netanyahu, are out of control of the United States. So that, and of course, the United States and the European countries themselves have severe limitations in terms of their ability to conclude these wars. I mean, in both cases, they are losing their respective wars. On top of that, just when it would actually be a good thing for them to say, okay, folks, let's cut our losses, let's do a deal, let's end this conflict, these two proxies have got the bit between their teeth, and they are, they can land the world in a very, very dangerous place.
Yeah, that's called chaos. If you can't win, just muck it up. Create chaos. And the two guys, it's the captain and the co-captain of chaos coming together and merging their teams. And it seems to me, you're absolutely right, that's what they're intending to do. There's where I think I would push back and think, I don't think Trump is dumb enough to buy that. I think he's already figured out Zelensky's game, obviously from his last meeting at the White House, where the only meeting was published like in black and white pictures. And I also think he's starting to push back a little bit on Netanyahu, although that probably remains to be seen. What do you think of that relationship between these two characters?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I'm always very loath to admit that Trump has any brains at all. I mean, I think maybe he has two or three gray cells, I'm not sure. And then he uses them to figure out his sort of short-term advantage.
Yeah.
I think that what Trump does is he for him, the short-term advantage is to prevent a scenario in which he has to admit defeat on any of these fronts. So that's what he's doing. That's why, as I explained, that's the yo-yo business. You know, today we are at war, tomorrow we are negotiating, today we are at war again, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what Trump is doing. The rest of it, what often appears as Trump's wisdom, is different parts of the increasingly ramshackle U.S. administration pulling in different directions.
Hmm.
as you know, I mean, right now, another news item I was reading is that both in the Republican and the Democratic primaries, the pro-war and anti-war camps are going to duke it out.
Mm.
So that you will have civil war-like situation in both the major parties.
Yeah, and the young people...
So that, so this is playing out domestically as well. So I would say that increasingly we are in a situation where nobody is in control.
No, it's as we've heard and as I reported earlier today and as I'm hearing from a lot of young people in the United States who don't pay attention to, you know, the CNNs and the Fox Newses of the world, they're going in their own direction. They feel like they're losing their country and something is going to break. We'll just have to, as the people like you and me who literally study this stuff or do the best we can to try and figure out and analyze it, these might be some interesting times that are coming ahead. Radhika, it's always a it's always such a pleasure. This reminds me of you and I drinking way too many cups of coffee at our conference recently that we had in Sochi and having long conversations about all of this. And here we get to do it on TV shared by a few of our friends. So thank you for gracing us and for your patience and for your time. You're so nice.
Thank you.
All right, let's do this. Let's talk about what we're going to be doing because there is a lot. I mentioned earlier today that once again, YouTube, which is basically a giant billionaire, trillionaire-owned tech company with ties to the Pentagon and the U.S. defense system, and they hate people like me. They don't want conversations like the one. They don't want you to know what we were just talking about. They don't want you to hear conversations about people who are saying we shouldn't be in all these stupid wars and that they're not doing anything for the people of America. Well, those people decided this morning to take me off of YouTube. So you're not allowed to get this message anymore on YouTube. But thankfully, at least for now, I'm on X. I'm on Spotify. I'm on, what else am I? Oh, Instagram. Instagram, big now, apparently. And most of all, BitChute. I'm on BitChute because there I am guaranteed I will not be demonetized. And I will not be, my information, my content will not disappear one night. And I will not be canceled. So that's another reason to check it out. YouTube, I'm Rick Sanchez. Thank you so much for letting us into your homes. And we'll be looking for you next time.